From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. First this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with author, poet, and podcast host Jared Anderson, who explores his lifelong depression through a lens of love and gratitude for the natural world. Then Jay Burke and I go on a wild ride with law enforcement veteran and best-selling author Ron Stallworth about his book, The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. That all coming up this hour. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our guest, Jared K. Anderson, is a writer, a poet, a podcaster, and someone who has made his musings about living with depression very public. He says treatment can be found in the woods, literally. And he gives us all the tools to see the woods all anew. You think you love a great blue heron flying across a body of water? Well, Jared Anderson loves it more than all of us. And he'll help us see it the way he does, in that way that calms, soothes, inspires, and balances our mental state. He's joining us now to discuss his new book called Something in the Woods Loves You. Jared Anderson, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
Well, you know, from the title of our show here, The Mountain Life, you know, we're lovers of nature here, and a lot of people move to the mountains because they are lovers of nature. But I will say that sometimes life in a mountain town can be very isolating, and that's a big topic about mental illness, challenges with mental wellness, and living in the mountains and feeling isolated. And I guess I just bring that up as a way to introduce you into this topic. But I think you live in Ohio.
I do.
Not very much in the mountains. Can you share your story with us?
Yeah. You know, the book takes place kind of, it launches off at a real low point in my mental health, where I was working as a director at a university, and ostensibly I had sort of made it. I had kind of reached an end point on my career goals. And I was looking at the next 40 years in this job that I had been kind of angling to get for some time. And I had this kind of bleak epiphany where I realized that I was just sort of miserable, that I had unchecked mental illness that I struggled to acknowledge because of shame and stigma. And I needed a dramatic break to sort of rediscover myself and to seek healing. So I stepped away from that job, and I felt like I was in a position to rebuild. And in trying to come back to sort of a foundational place for myself, the obvious path forward for me was nature.
I think it is for a lot of people, but it's not until you find out that that is so, that you do find that nature is something that can soothe you, that can heal you. How did you go about finding out?
Well, you know, I think part of the problem was shame and silence that really disincentivized me from acknowledging my own mental illness. You know, depression defends itself and depression lies to you. And so depression never feels like depression. You'll always think, okay, well, depression is a fine word for other people, but me, I'm just being realistic. I'm just being objective. I'm sad because the world is objectively sad, or my life is objectively broken. And so it takes an embrace of a kind of productive but terrifying vulnerability to even set foot on the path of healing in the context of mental health. But when I did that, when I really started, I also found that that path, along with seeking medication and therapy, that path led me back to my childhood love of the woods. Some of my earliest memories are nature walks with my mom, looking at the spring ephemerals and green herons and songbirds, and you know, she would befriend deer and crows. And coming back to that, I had to set aside the kind of external pressures that were on me to focus on practicality and productivity. And even in terms of my own masculinity, the sort of idealization of stoic silence. And setting those things aside allowed me to come back to nature and think, I can come to nature just for the sake of coming to nature, and which is its own kind of healing. And then, you know, once I'm out among the trees, I felt a kind of huge relief that a lot of those external pressures seemed to melt away, the performative pressures to be a, you know, a certain kind of son or father or employee or client or, you know, offer a sales pitch. I just had this sense that it was medicinal to be out there, and a lot of those pressures seemed to disappear.
That's wonderful. I think that anybody who's grown up near wilderness or whatever knows that when you're a kid, it feels so natural just to kind of mesh with the outdoor world. Even your parents are shoving you outside, right? Go outside, go out and play. Yeah. And as you get older and older, it gets a little trickier to find and make time for those experiences. Well, at times your new book, Something in the Woods Loves You, reminded me a little bit of Matt Haig's book, Reasons to Stay Alive, or Richard Powers' The Overstory, in that they discussed our personal narratives, depression, and some of the grand metaphors that nature offers for understanding ourselves. What is it that you think happens in nature that makes us feel good or feel better?
As somebody who struggles with chronic major depression, part of the real insidious nature of it is abstraction, right? There's this placelessness to it where you're constantly shoved into these kind of imaginings, the most negative imaginings you can come up with about yourself. Shame and guilt and condemnation, and all of it feels too slippery to take a hold of. Well, part of my journey to mental health is writing it down, capturing it on paper so that I can actually interrogate these thoughts, have discussions with them so they're not so abstract. But I think journeying into nature is almost akin to that practice, where it brings us back to physicality and sort of the physicality of the moment, where we're here, anchored in the here and now, where our power and agency actually resides. And being out in the woods, it always calls up all my senses in a different way. You know, it engages smell and the, you know, the tang of leaf litter and sight. What am I looking at? What's the pattern of lichen on this tree? Like, what distant bird call am I hearing? And it brings me back to this sort of anchored physicality of the moment, which can be a real antidote, I think, to the painful abstractions that are really haunting about depression and anxiety.
Oh, absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. In your book, you mentioned a number of things about ADHD and depression, which are both elements of my life as well. And so many of us struggle with this idea of both needing them and hating all of the multi forms of sensory stimulation in our lives right now. Somewhere in an interview or something of yours, I read about how you might be in front of the video game console and having something else that you're listening to and a fan blowing on you. And I totally get that. Like, sometimes I'll be strumming on a guitar or something, but the TV will be on, and people who have more maybe neurotypical brains don't understand how this is even a pleasurable thing. How do you think that nature kind of works with this conflicted state that we're in?
Yeah, that's absolutely me. I very much do audiobook plus video game plus fan. I've used a hairdryer before, which has really got me some looks. But with depression, it's funny because the mind is the tool that can lead me out of depression, but it's also the seed of the disease. And so all that stimulation helps me not have some kind of part of my mind running loose in a way where I'm worried that it's going to start chewing on me, honestly, when I don't have kind of the energy, especially on a tough day, to be really intentional about my own thoughts. And taking a walk in the woods, and trust me, there are days when I don't want to, and I have to make little deals with myself in the same way I have to do to take a shower on the hard days. But just getting out there, even if it's a mechanical act, it's a leap of faith that this will help, even though I don't want to. Once I'm out there, it always short circuits the pathways of depression for me. And even the bad days out in the woods are better than if I kind of turn inward and stay in my room. And I really do think it is a little bit akin to that sensory overload we're talking about, but in a more nourishing way is how I feel about it, because I think what we're trying to create when we reach for all the sort of artificial stimuli are something akin to walking beneath the trees, and there's so many things calling for your attention. But the added benefit to walking in the woods is all those things that are calling for my intention are something that I feel kind of an instinctual, innate love for. And the extended metaphor I feel there is that when I'm out in the woods, when I feel that effortless love for the landscape and the trees and the birds, I intellectually understand that I'm as much a part of nature as the maple tree I'm walking toward, as the bird song I hear in the distance. So the nagging question becomes, okay, why can't I extend the same kind of effortless love toward myself? And I think that question hangs in the air when I'm out walking beneath the trees.
Wow, that's a really interesting point and question that you turn back on yourself. You say in your book, and it's a reading I'm going to ask you to do, a couple paragraphs, you say that there are two paths to magic, imagination and paying attention.
Yeah, I'll do a little reading here on that subject. There are two paths to magic, imagination and paying attention. Imagination is the fiction we love, the truths built of falsehoods, glowing dust on the water's surface. Paying attention is about intentional noticing, participating in making meaning to lend new weight to our world. An acorn, the geometry of a beehive, the complexity of whale song, the perfect slowness of a heron. Real magic requires your intention, your choice to harmonize. Of course it does. The heron cannot cast starlight onto the dark shallows to entrance bluegills, not unless you do your part. You must choose to meet her halfway. And when you do, you may find that magic isn't a dismissal of what is real. It's a synthesis of it, the nectar of fact becoming the honey of meaning. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about meaning making. And I do that partly because it was a startling revelation to me that as I worked my way out of depression, it cleared the table for contentment. It set the stage, but it wasn't the same as contentment. You know, I had success with some medication. I had some success with CBT, but I came to understand that contentment and happiness are a skill. It's a skill set, and it wasn't a skill set I had spent much time on. And it really comes down to this idea of meaning making. And, you know, in the book, I talk about enthusiasm. I talk about whimsy, and I talk about magical thinking, but it's all tied to this idea that we have the power and agency to make our own meaning. And what we need to bring to that craft, to that making of meaning, is kindness for ourselves and kind of a stubborn insistence on making our worlds a place of wonder, a place that's fun to experience and worthy of our attention.
We're speaking with Jared K. Anderson, his book, Something in the Woods Loves You. As you were just talking about this, Jared, it made me think about all the people now who are using things like psilocybin and ketamine under a guided situation to deal with their depression or, you know, even some other things. That going through nature in the way that you are paying attention is kind of like a trip in and of itself.
I've never tried the drugs. I sometimes get comments on something I post, like, oh, geez, I want to try what you're taking. And it's like, oh, I'm just like this. If we're talking about something subjective like happiness or contentment or thinking that you matter, for me, like, it hardly matters what the path is. When I set out to write this book too, I wanted to be careful not to be dismissive or bring toxic positivity. I didn't want to be one of those people who's like, go touch a tree and you'll feel better. You know, it's so much more complicated than that. But when I find meaning in nature, often what I'm finding meaning in are just the raw facts. It's just that with a little bit of imagination and intention, you can see them in new ways. I mean, you know, we live in a world where squids the size of a school bus, you know, patrol dark waters at a depth that would crush you to paste. That's just true. That's where we live. If you just look at sort of the bare facts of nature, yes, we can breathe, and we're using oxygen made by phytoplankton and trees, but why does it work? It works because we have iron in our blood that binds to the oxygen. And where did that iron come from? It came from the mountains and the hills and from ancient stars. And these are all absolutely true, and they become invisible through being commonplace. I have a 5-year-old now, and I'll take him out to the woods, and I'll see him shake with excitement at seeing a bumblebee. And I'll think, okay, look at that. That's just natural and instinctual for him, but it isn't for me anymore. So I have to bring a certain kind of intentionality to it. But what I'm reaching for is something that I think is built into us, that sense of wonder and awe for the natural world. And that's something that's a, for me, it's a good foundation for my meaning making.
I love that term, meaning making, because so many things we can get through in life if we just feel that there is meaning and there is wisdom in it and there is forward movement of some kind. There's a long history associating artists with mental illness or mood disorders like depression. And I read somewhere that you had said that some of your favorite poems have come from some of your worst days, which is something I think most creative people can identify with. What do you feel is the connection between powerful art and pain? And can we work through or heal our pain by making art?
I think we heal our pain most effectively through connection. And I think that's where art comes in. It took me a long time to face my own mental illness because of shame and because of fear of vulnerability. But the problem is vulnerability and authenticity are linked concepts. Showing your real self, showing our real selves, exposes us in a way that can feel terrifying. But it's also the way you make actual connections. And the same can be said of the creative process. I mean, I think people have this sort of innate feeling for when you're BSing them. And so good art, in my experience, and good writing comes from embracing the fear, sitting in it, of actually bringing your authentic self to the conversation. So that doesn't necessarily need to be prompted by pain. You know, I get itchy about this idea that pain makes good art because I largely don't want it. But yes. Pain can be what prompts us to push past certain fears. And for me, it was that fear of vulnerability. And I think the pain did help me realize that, all right, whatever fear I'm bringing to this conversation in terms of vulnerability is the lesser evil when I'm talking about reaching out for connection and authenticity to heal my own mental illness.
Exactly. I feel that. I'm going to quote a piece that's an older piece of yours called Leaf Litter, which I loved, because when you talk about making the connection that might be where the healing is, sometimes the connection maybe is with other people, sometimes it's with your environment, sometimes with ideas. It starts, "Today is a hard one. I'm failing to shower, to eat, to do anything. I feel the weight of what's beneath my bed. The untuned mandolin, the knotted jump rope, the worksheets from therapy, the books I almost read. All these things were once me discarded, but for their hunger for my space and my thoughts. Where are they now? My depression says defeats. Red ink on the permanent record, a dragon's hoard of wasted hours." And then it unfolds a bit and you say, "But I see the woods beyond my window and they say something different. Leaf litter on the forest floor slowly becoming soil does not represent the failure of past summer's trees. It's the process by which the past nourishes the present and future. The same is true for my old selves, my bygone passions, last season's interests." I love this so much. And I think it's a really good example of the kind of meaning and connection and metaphor that you could look forward to as someone reading Jared K. Anderson's new book, Something in the Woods Loves You. It's very human, and yet it's so much bigger than human, right? It's the way we're woven into this pattern of life that's so much bigger than us. Do you sense when you're in the woods, when you're just looking at something, how it might relate to your big ideas, or is it come about some other way?
Sometimes is the truth. You know, sometimes I'm sitting and working on it, and sometimes, you know, it's good that I have a journal because it comes to me in a flash. But I mean, what that poem is pointing to is the generosity we often kind of thoughtlessly apply to the natural world. You don't look at leaves on the ground and think, oh, nice job, oak. Like, you really screwed up. Like, no, like, it's just part of cycles and seasons. And you take that generosity you feel and find ways to turn it back to yourself is one of the great healing properties I find in nature. One of the big metaphors, and, you know, I'm a language guy, I'm a poet. I feel like my power is in metaphor, and sometimes it's a healing power. One of the metaphors that's been really helpful to me is thinking of my own mental illness as brain weather. And it's if you want to have a picnic and it gets canceled because of a thunderstorm, you'd be disappointed. You wouldn't be ashamed. Okay, well, mental illness, depression, anxiety, they're all as natural as a thunderstorm. These are known, observed things. Like the thunderstorm, you don't invite them into your own head. You understand logically, you don't steer the clouds. So why have any more shame about mental illness than you would about a thunderstorm canceling a picnic? And that kind of lesson from just observing nature, when I started to bring that kind of understanding back to my own life to get out from under the shame and guilt, well, that's when I can start to actually build and start to journey toward healing. But it takes a kind of imaginative empathy to take the grace, the balance, the sense of wholeness I feel in nature, and then say, okay, but I'm also nature. You know, my brain came about in exactly the same natural pathway as an oak leaf. So why am I heaping all of this scorn on myself for my struggles?
Yeah. Wow. Those are great metaphors. You know, Jared, you've in this interview so far, you've probably mentioned the word shame about 5 or 6 times. And I'm wondering if developing those metaphors for yourself really flipped the page for you on the shame, or did it take a lot of therapy? Because I know shame is huge, even if you're not talking about mental illness. There are many aspects of all of our lives that can include shame. It's really a debilitating emotion.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I mean, I think therapy helped me identify shame as one of the big hurdles. But the thing I have found about therapy is you can hear a concept in therapy. You know, you can hear kind of somebody can point out a thing you're doing. But for me, it doesn't come home. It doesn't take root in a way that really helps with kind of my inner weather until I figure out a way to phrase it for myself, until I like take ownership of it. And, you know, again, I'm a words guy. So when I can land on the metaphor that clicks for me, that's when I know I really have something.
Right. Yeah. Well, since we're talking metaphors and things, there's something about the great blue heron, as I said in the intro, it's one of the things in nature that that and the call of the loon, I think those two things just stop me dead in my tracks, and it makes me focus in on nature. Can you just give us your poetic look at something like the great blue heron?
I mean, the magic is in where I connect with the bird. I mean, for me, the magic of the great blue heron is half the bird and half me. And the story I tell in the book is when I had turned away from nature for a long time and coming back to the woods and walking a path next to a crooked stream and coming around a bend and seeing a great blue heron in the distance and just stopping in my tracks and feeling tears on my cheek. And it was the moment where I thought to myself, you know, it's all still here, that I'm fooling myself when I was thinking that nature was somehow trapped in the past or it was a relic of childhood. It's still here beneath the sky, and all I have to do is do my part to meet it halfway. So gray blue herons are wonderful, magical birds, but, you know, like a lot of what I bring to nature, it's partly them and partly me and what we do together that I think is special in terms of meaning making.
Well, I just wondered if there's any lasting feeling or message or inspiration that you hope readers will take away from this book.
You know, the shame metaphor I shared, I think, is really helpful. And honestly, just you're worth it. You deserve to find contentment. Sometimes it feels like a leap of faith to start almost mechanically doing the walk toward healing, but do it even if it feels ridiculous, or even if you don't necessarily connect with where you're going, that it's worth it to try to walk the path toward healing, even if you don't know exactly where you're going at first.
The book is Something in the Woods Loves You, and our guest is Jared K. Anderson. You know, even if you aren't someone who struggles with mental health challenges, this book is a phenomenal way to get you connected to nature. It's really for everyone. So, Jared, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you. It's been so lovely to chat with you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Our next guest, Ron Stallworth, is a law enforcement veteran and the first Black detective in the Colorado Springs Police Department. He's worked undercover in narcotics, vice, criminal intelligence, and organized crime beats in four states. He's the author of the number one New York Times bestselling memoir, Black Klansman, which became an Oscar-winning Spike Lee film. He joins us now to take us on a very unlikely journey through the heart of LDS country here in Utah, where he worked and uncovered a scenario that he never expected. Bloods and Crips infiltrating the Salt Lake Valley, threatening to turn this deeply conservative community into a hotbed of crime. His new book, released this month, is called The Gangs of Zion, a Black Cops Crusade in Mormon Country. Ron Stallworth, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, how are you all?
Yeah, welcome.
We're well. Let's start off with the background behind what brought you to the Salt Lake Valley in the mid-80s?
Very simply, I was on a quest to pursue my ambition to be an undercover cop. I had been working in Wyoming, Cheyenne, Wyoming, for 4 years, from 82 to 86. And Cheyenne is not exactly a hotbed of activity, culture, or anything else, unless you're a cowboy. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend at the Department of Public Safety's Liquor Law Enforcement Bureau who told me they were hiring, and he suggested I put an application in. So I applied in 1984, and there was a budget crunch. He told me to hang in there. As soon as they clear up the budget mess, we're going to hire you. It took them 2 years, and in 1986, I finally got my marching orders, and I made the step from Cheyenne to Salt Lake City, to Layton.
And at that point, did you have any experience working in an anti-gang unit or experience with gangs?
No, I had not worked gangs at all prior to, in fact, my only encounter with gangs was dealing with a few skinheads in Colorado Springs while I was doing the Klan investigation. But I didn't really handle any gang activity at all until I moved to Utah.
Ron, on the topic of Utah, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, I mean, it's no secret. I mean, Utah is a very vanilla state. Talk to us just a little bit about what was it like coming to Utah in the 80s and 90s as a Black man?
Well, Wyoming was a vanilla state too, more vanilla than Utah.
That's for sure.
I got there. The only Black person in the Department of Public Safety at that time was my boss, Bureau Chief in charge of narcotics and liquor law enforcement, James Gillespie. Jim and I knew each other, and he had a hand in my being hired. But in terms of field agents, there were no other Blacks. We were separate from the Utah Highway Patrol. They had no blacks working in the highway patrol at that time. So I was basically the only black on the department. It wasn't anything unusual for me because I was the first black detective in Colorado Springs. When I went to Wyoming, I was the only black undercover cop in the entire state of Wyoming. That made for some interesting scenarios as to why are you in our town? I have an anecdote in my book about one of those encounters. But it was very challenging. I had to come up with excuses for why I was in Utah. I always had to go through the problem of being recruited by the church. My biggest challenge was learning how to navigate the cultural waters, yeah, about respecting their beliefs, their religious feelings, while at the same time maintaining my personal integrity.
I couldn't imagine. You come to Utah, you take this position. I mean, did you come here knowing that there was gang activity, or was this something that surfaced as you got into your tenure here? Tell us a little bit about that. And I know it was challenging, I think, as well on that side, convincing people in Utah that there were actually was gang activity in here.
You don't know the half of it. I got to Utah in 1986, summer of 86. And the gang activity didn't emerge for me until around 1988. I was made a crack cocaine buy of a Crip gang member, which I thought was unusual. He was black from South Central LA. I made one of the first crack buys in the state. It was only $100 worth, about a gram. But I noticed these blue and red clad black men from South Central LA in Salt Lake City and Ogden. I also had read a report from the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department, stating that Bloods and Crips from South Central are migrating to points west, Utah being one of them, and that they were migrating to Utah to open up new crack cocaine markets and to spread their gang culture. I read this memo and I decided to look into it. What I discovered was that, yes, there were red and blue clad kids in Salt Lake City and in Ogden. And yes, they were selling crack cocaine. So I wrote a report to Bureau Chief Gillespie. And in that report, I explained to him that this is what's happening in our environment. We're being inundated with gang members from LA. They're coming here. At that time, I didn't know how they were coming here. I later found out Job Corps was bringing them, Clearfield Job Corps program. I said, they're coming here. They're doing this. They're setting up crack cocaine markets. I said, and they're establishing new gang connections. So I wrote the report. I wrote down a recommendation for how we should address it, how we in Utah law enforcement should address it. I had four bullet points. We should first become aware and acknowledge that the problem existed. Second, we should educate the law enforcement community about the scope of the problem. What was going on? Why? How? I said, then we should unite with the media and educate the public, the community at large, win them over to our side. And then I said, we should attack the problem with all aggressiveness, because one of the things in the LAPD report said, when you see this problem, don't let it fester. Jump on it hard, and put a stop to it while it's in its infancy, or else it'll be out of control and you can't control it. So that was my recommendation. That was my report.
Ron, let me just interrupt you to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Ron Stallworth. He's a law enforcement veteran, and he's just written a new book, The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. He's a best-selling author of a book called Black Klansmen, which became an Oscar-winning Spike Lee film, and that one was a memoir. This one, partially memoir as well. And Ron, did you at that point have any idea of the numbers of Bloods and Crips that were infiltrating the Salt Lake Valley in the late 80s?
No, no idea whatsoever. All I knew is that you can walk down downtown Ogden in downtown Salt Lake City, especially on weekends, and you would see the red and blue all over. It was alarming. It was interesting. It was alarming, fascinating, actually, to see these black guys in Mormon country. No idea how many there were.
And so as you made this report and sort of laid out what your plan was and that you felt like the police chief, you know, should adopt, what were you encountered with? I mean, was there, I'm assuming, and I believe there was a lot of disbelief around this. At that point in time, you know, it was very vanilla, as Jay used that word, and it was very, there wasn't a lot of crime here. Not a lot was going on here in Utah at that time. So what did you come up against?
Well, I immediately came up against the religion because right off the bat, the defense was we couldn't possibly have gang members here from LA, black gang members. We're a Mormon community. We're conservative. We're white. It couldn't possibly be happening here. And I say, yes, you're Mormon, you're conservative, you're white, and you also have black gang members from LA. No, no, we're a religious community. And I'd say crap to that. Your religion has nothing to do with the fact that you have black gang members selling crack cocaine, spreading their gang culture. I ran into this brick wall of denial, and it was denied based on those three things: religion, white, and conservative. That was the prevailing argument that I was up against.
I mean, a question that comes to my mind was this, and we're talking on crack, was crack, were there people here that were wanting the product, or was it a situation of, I mean, you had this infiltration, it was making this product available? Because I think that, I mean, obviously outside of Utah, that whole problem was probably much greater than it was here. So did they almost come and create the market to some degree?
No, white Mormons like drugs too.
Yeah, okay.
You know, religion has nothing to do with it. these guys basically would come into communities, establish themselves with the local drug market, and they were off and running. And Utah was no different. I also heard I said religion, race, white, and conservatism were the three arguments against this being a problem. That was what I heard where gangs were concerned. That's what I heard where the drugs were concerned. If you know where to go, you can find the drug markets. And these kids were well-versed in the drug market and established it. They had customers on the ready when they got here. Crack was something new. It was spreading from South Central all over the country. And it was our turn to be in the spotlight.
Well, so you talk a bit about denial, and specifically, not necessarily denial from the community at large, but really more from the departments in these communities. I mean, you talk specifically about Ogden, I know, and then Chief Joe Ritchie. And then you also talk about Price, which I think some of our listeners will probably be like, Price, Utah in the 80s. I mean, how in the world? But both, it sounds like in reading the book, you know, part of the book here, that both of those chiefs in those communities pushed extremely hard on this, and there was that you were showing them hard evidence. Why was that? Was there monetary benefit?
No, the chiefs were very much in denial. They didn't want their communities to have a reputation which they had no control over. And rather than address a problem, they chose to double down on the problem and deny that the problem existed. Not in our communities. We're this community. We're that community. Couldn't possibly have black Blood and Crip gang members from Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles, in our good, clean, white community. They were in total denial. Salt Lake City Police Department was in denial. They were not allowed to use the term gangs on police reports at that time in the Salt Lake City Police Department. They had to call them community groups or youth groups, but you could not say gangs. Me being a state cop, I said gangs every time I had a conversation with somebody, every time I talked to someone on the phone, every time I had a press interview. I said gangs, gangs, gangs. They couldn't control me. The chiefs were in denial, and they didn't want to address the fact that this problem existed and do the right thing by their constituents and address the problem. In other words, they were doing the exact opposite of what LAPD advocated, and that was jump on the problem immediately and put all resources into it to put a stop to it. So by their being in denial, they contributed to that growth because that allowed this problem to fester, and it just grew and grew and grew till it was totally out of control, and then we had to play catch up. Never caught up, by the way. You still haven't caught up in Utah.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ron Stallworth about his book, The Gangs of Zion. Ron, there's another part of this story that I'd like to get into now. Something you were finding is that young, white, Mormon men were somehow connecting themselves to these gangs. And this is a whole complex layer to add on top of it. How did that happen?
Well, my partner and I, my partner, by the way, who the book is dedicated to, the late Kevin Crane, a hell of a guy, good cop. Kevin Crane and I were on patrol in gang patrol in downtown Salt Lake. And we ran across these, I believe there were four of them, four white kids dressed in blue. We knew they were Crips by their dress. We asked them, how are you guys learning about street gang behavior? This is Utah. Well, Utah, quote unquote, didn't have gangs. How are you learning about it? They said from the rap music we listened to. Now, I, like most people in America, I was familiar with Rapper Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. 15 minutes long, used to piss me off every time it came on because I was into Stevie Wonder and Motown and all those. And this 15-minute song, quote unquote, where they didn't sing, they talked, it would come on, and it would just upset me to no end. But I also noticed it had a catchy tune, catchy beat, catchy lyrics, and was kind of cute when you took the time to listen to it.
Right.
So I would ask them, that was my introduction to rap music. So I would ask these kids, where are you learning it from? They said, from the rap music we listened to. I said, what kind of rap? I knew nothing about style at that time. And they said, gangster rap. So I contacted the chief of police at the time. He was a lieutenant in the Compton Police Department, Compton, California, which is a haven for Crips and Bloods. And I asked the chief, Huey Taylor, I said, what do you know about, I said, I've got Mormon kids here, white kids who think they are black Crips and Bloods. In fact, these kids sounded so much like black gang members that if I had turned my back on them and held a conversation, I would have sworn I was talking to black kids and not white kids because they had the language down. They had the speech pattern. They had everything down, but they were white and they were Mormon. I asked Chief Taylor, what are you hearing? Are you hearing about some of your constituents coming to Utah? He said, no. He said, but there's an album out called Straight Outta Compton by NWA, Niggas With Attitude. Go buy it, listen to it. This will answer a lot of the questions that you have. So I did. I went down to the mall downtown across from the Delta Center at Crossroads Mall, bought the album, got in my car and was headed north to Layton where I live. And I almost had three accidents while driving because I was laughing so hard. I couldn't believe that there was this type of music that was being exported across the airwaves. I was fascinated. Needless to say, I started studying the music, and by God, what did I find? It was a primer on how to be a Crip and a Blood, and in some cases, how to sell crack cocaine. All you had to do was listen to it and break it apart. No cop in America was doing that at the time until I came along, and I started listening to this music, studying it, deciphering it. It opened my eyes.
Ron, I'm wondering, I mean, it sort of dates all of us, right? I remember Rapper's Delight and the funny lyrics, you know, have you ever been over a friend's house to eat and the food just ain't no good? You know, those were funny. They were funny. I mean, I sang that and I knew every word to it. And, you know, what is the evolution of gangster rap from something that made you laugh when you first heard it and almost getting three accidents driving down the road listening to it because you were laughing, to the part where you felt like it was, you know, the lyrics were infiltrating the minds of these people listening to it to, you know, help them along their criminal pathway?
Like any musical style, rap has different genres. Gangster rap came into existence about the time I was dealing with this problem in Utah. You had party rap, which was Rapper Delight. It was just having a good time, dancing to the beat, enjoying life. Over time, rap music evolved to where you had different genres of rap, gangster rap being one of them. Gangster rap was unique to the culture. It was started in one of the origins of gangster rap was in L.A. It actually started in Philadelphia. And as it spread, it got more hardcore. What was impacting me, where I thought it was funny, was when I turned on the Straight Outta Compton album, and the first song that played was Sleep the Police. When I heard that song, I thought, they can't be making music like this. There is no filter in this music. It comes straight at you with those words, and it talks about killing cops.
Yeah.
To me, it was hilarious as hell. I wasn't threatened by it. I was laughing at it because it cracked me up. I couldn't believe the boldness of these kids. And some of these kids were 18 years old, 17, 18 years old. I couldn't believe the boldness of it. And I just started laughing as I'm driving down the highway listening to it. And I listened to it three times. The first two times, I was cracking up laughing. The third time, I started paying serious attention, and I paid serious attention from that point on.
Well, Ron, so along these lines, I mean, you're listening to these lyrics, and I think you gain some expertise in breaking this down, which led to you testifying in Washington, D.C. about the influence that gangster rap was having on kids across America, I mean, specifically in Utah. Can you tell us a little about that?
This started in 1988, my study of rap music, gangster rap. Right around 1992, Congress held the first congressional hearings on gangster rap music and its impact on American society. I wrote a paper. It was about, 12 pages long, breaking down what I had discovered listening to the music and what was happening in the Utah environment where the music was concerned and where gangs were concerned. And I sent that paper, mailed it off to the senator holding the hearing, Carol Moseley Braun of Chicago, told her, I think this will help you in your pursuit of this topic. Well, lo and behold, she called me up and invited me to appear at the hearing. I knew that my superiors at the Department of Public Safety would not let me go, and I wanted to go. So I didn't tell anyone that at DPS that this had happened. I just decided to take vacation days and on my own time, my own dime, fly to the Capitol and testify at this hearing. So that's what I did. I was the only cop in the country invited to this hearing, and I was the only cop to appear at the hearing to give testimony. And that's when I started to make a national name for myself, slowly but surely. And that's when I started alerting the public at large that this is what our children are listening to. This is what, when they walk around with boom boxes to their ears at the time and later AirPods, this is what's going on in their heads. They know this music intimately. At one time, I took an assessment of myself and I knew 150 gangster rap songs that I could recite at a lecture presentation. I knew the lyrics in some of the cases I knew the entire song, and others I knew snippets of the song to illustrate the points I wanted to make. So if I, as a 40-year-old man, could ingrain that music in my head just by listening occasionally, imagine what it was doing to the kids who constantly had boomboxes against their ears, who constantly had ear pods in their ears, and who were listening to it on a regular basis. So at one point, I played the lyrics on a cassette tape in my lectures. I would play the lyrics, stop it, talk to the audience about what you had just heard, and then play a little more. And then one day I was given appearing at the Los Angeles Sheriff's Academy Advanced Gang School. And I was asked if I could fill in for an instructor who failed to show up. I took an assessment. I didn't have my cassettes with me. I took a quick assessment and realized I had ingrained most of these songs from memory. So I told the instructor, yes, I can. I got up in front of an audience cold, no preparation whatsoever, and proceeded to recite the lyrics of about 5 different albums, maybe 3 songs off each album, from memory. The audience was mesmerized. They didn't believe that a cop, a 40-year-old cop, could do this. And that got me started on how I would present the material from that point on, and on lecturing around the country, because the invitations to appear at conferences came flying in. And I traveled around the country doing lectures, telling people about what was going on with gangster rap music in their communities, and became a de facto quote unquote gang expert nationwide.
Well, Ron Stallworth has been our guest. He's a best-selling author, and he's just releasing a new book called The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. Ron Stallworth, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. Really interesting.